From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republicans will see their majority in the Senate go up to 53, with the Democrats at 47 seats, now that Cindy Hyde-Smith held on to hers in that runoff election in Mississippi. And Democrats in the House face a key decision today, whether to make Nancy Pelosi their next speaker.
And there are some new twists and turns in the FBI's Russia investigation. So let's bring our political strategists in. John Brabender, Republican strategist. Hi, John.
Hello.
And Jamal Simmons, Democrat and host at Hill TV. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. So over the past 2 days, just in the Mueller investigation, we have learned that Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, has been accused of lying to prosecutors with whom he cut a plea deal. He's been telling Trump lawyers what kinds of questions the special counsel, Robert Mueller, has been asking him. Jamal, what do you think is coming next in this investigation?
Well, it seems like we've just got a parade of pariahs that have been coming out of the Trump world over the last few days. You've got Manafort, who hasn't been telling the truth, apparently, to the special prosecutor. You've got Jerome Corsi, who is the father of the Obama birther right. conspiracy and a bunch of other conspiracies. And Roger Stone, who it seems like is back in the news, but Corsi is saying that, you know, he apparently had some emails telling Stone that there were going to be more emails coming from WikiLeaks at the time. And now he's saying he doesn't remember, even though this was one of the biggest scandals of the 2016 campaign. It just looks an awful lot like there is more to this story, the Guardian story, that Manafort was meeting with Assange, with people are worried about. I think we're about to find out something really big about the Trump campaign collusion with
the Russians.
Do you
agree with that, John?
Well, no. I mean, let's review. First of all, what they have convicted Paul Manafort on had absolutely nothing to do with the Russian investigation and nothing to do with his short, brief period with the Trump campaign before he was dismissed. So that's number one. Number two is that, you know, first of all, I don't understand why no one ever talks about that if Hillary Clinton and Podesta wouldn't have been writing conspiratorial emails about how to get the left, the progressive wing of the Democrat Party, WikiLeaks wouldn't even have had anything to release. So, you know, if Paul Manafort was involved in that, if Roger Stone was not involved with the Trump campaign, you know, great, that's fine. If that's what 18 months of investigation and a lot of money is going to find. But what does that have to do with Donald Trump, I guess, and the Trump campaign?
Well, what it might
come
to.
There was a theft, right, John? they broke into the DNC servers, the Hillary Clinton servers, John Podesta's emails. Probably the Russians, and they gave it to WikiLeaks, so they're trafficking in stolen emails.
Hey, we're all in agreement that the Russians tried to interfere in our elections. We should be resolute. We should be unified in going after them. There should be consequences to that. But to then try to broaden that to areas that we've seen no proof, I can understand why the president is frustrated with this investigation.
Well, just don't blame Hillary Clinton and John Podesta for what they wrote in emails and not blame the people
who broke
into their email and
stole
it.
But you do agree they were trying to conspire against Bernie Sanders and the progressive wing of the Democrat Party.
I don't.
Right?
I believe they were running a campaign.
Well,
okay.
And there's a difference, I guess, Jamal is saying, between running a hard-fought intra-party campaign and colluding with the Russians, which is what this investigation is trying to figure out. Did somebody talk to somebody who had gotten something from the Russians and relay that to the Trump campaign? We don't know yet. But John Brabender, you asked about Manafort, and one of the questions is why would he violate a plea deal, which was going to keep him out of jail, maybe for the maybe looking at the rest of his life in jail. And the answer. The speculative answer is that because he knows that Donald Trump will pardon him. Do you think
he
should?
Well, I don't think he knows Donald Trump. I think you do have to look this.
No,
and I think you're
I'm saying it's speculative.
The right way.
Yeah.
You have to look at this from Manafort's perspective, not Trump, not Mueller's. Manafort is looking for a long time in jail. There's two ways to get out of it, right? Either make the Mueller investigators so happy that they want to go soft on him and tell a judge to do that. Or he can get a pardon down the road. I think what he's doing is trying to play both those games at once, trying to send some message to the Trump people that, hey, I'm not going to make up things. I'm not going to do anything to save my skin and throw you under the bus. And at the same time, act like he's cooperating. And I think that it's not impossible that he's going to get caught doing that and it's going to have poor consequences for him.
Well, now that we have all come to an agreement and solved the Russia investigation, let's move on to another big story in the news. Mississippi Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith won in yesterday's special election runoff. Let's listen to her in her victory speech last night.
The reason we won is because Mississippians know me and they know my heart. And thank you for stepping up, Mississippi.
And then here is her opponent, Democrat Mike Espy.
Do you know that we built the largest grassroots organization our state has ever seen in a generation? Yeah. And we did that through a coalition of voters, white and black, who shared our belief that Mississippi's future will be brighter than Mississippi's past.
Jamal, you know, Espy didn't win, but it was a pretty close race when you think about the fact that it's Mississippi. Do you think that both parties have something to be happy about here?
Well, I'm sure Mike Espy is not happy today. Losing an election is never
You think
a good
he thought
thing.
He was going to win?
I think he thought he had a shot at it, and he wanted to win.
Does it matter that he did better than any Democratic candidate in that race in 30 years?
Sure, it matters to us, and sure, it's a good consolation prize. But when you run a campaign, you want to win. I think that the broader issues of what happened this election, and this is more evidence of it, which is that there is a coalition of Americans that is growing, that is beginning to reject the kind of white nationalist ideology being put forward by President Trump and his allies. And they're looking at an America where everybody gets to participate regardless of what you look like and who you love. And I think that is the broader coalition that is emerging. And we saw that in Mike Espy's vote total, too.
I want to switch gears just a bit and look ahead at the G20 summit coming this weekend. President Trump says he may meet with the Saudi crown prince, may meet with him on the sidelines. Of course, this is the crown prince that the CIA thinks most likely ordered the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. President Trump said again in his interviews yesterday, Washington Post and others, he just, you know, if the crown prince said he didn't do it, then he didn't do it. He may have done it, may not have done it. And then there's also a potential meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, although we know there are reports today that President Trump has just spoken with the president of Turkey with concerns over Russia seizing those Ukrainian ships in those shared waters. John Brabender, what should he do? Should he meet with the crown prince?
Well, I'm glad you're leaving this all up to me. I'm sure the president's waiting to hear my answer. But look, I think you have to understand this administration has been strong in a lot of the rhetoric, particularly the vice president, in calling the concerns that we have. But whether we like it or not, this still is an important ally for us both economically and from a national security standpoint. And what everybody is finding amazing on the Republican side is you had President Obama having this relationship with Iran, who is an enemy of ours on security and economy. Here's somebody who's been a friend of ours. You have to at least continue a dialogue. You have to continue a relationship. But it's like a relative that sometimes you have to call out and be honest enough with them and call something the way it is. We cannot put up with what apparently did happen. We have to be strong in our rhetoric that announces that. But what we shouldn't do if we're really thinking about America first and Americans first is to simply get rid of the relationship.
Jamal?
I think that if Donald Trump has a financial relationship either in the past or a possibility of one in the future with the Saudis, the House Democrats are going to uncover it and we will know about it soon.
Okay.
So there is a question about whether we're about to face another government shutdown at the end of next week if Democrats don't agree to give President Trump $5 million for a border wall instead of the $1.6 billion that's on the table. Yesterday, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said no way to that money.
The Republicans are in control of the presidency, the House, and the Senate. A shutdown is on their back. Stick to the $1.6 billion.
John, let me start with you. Do you think there should be a shutdown over this issue?
Well, first of all, I find it interesting that the person that just said those words were the ones one responsible for what was called the Schumer shutdown. But anyhow, look, I always think there should not be a shutdown. I think it's appalling and embarrassing for every American that you have Republicans and Democrats not be able to work things out, but to simply have this type of political rhetoric that we see from both sides. And what it leads is to a stalemate and nothing gets done and it leads to a shutdown. I don't know who benefits from that. So I think that there should not be a shutdown. I don't think there's an advantage to anybody. And I think that they both are to blame if that happens.
Jamal?
I think there shouldn't be a shutdown, but the president is going to have to deal with this House Democratic caucus and their Senate allies a little differently than he's had to deal with them in the past. They are going through some growing pains. And let me just say, we've got a lot of business to do for the country. And until we find out how he's connected to Saudis and Russians and other people and all the crimes that have been committed in this administration, they're going to have to do some work for the country.
Sean Braeburn, I'm going to give you 30 seconds because you're the Republican strategist and therefore the consultant. What would you tell President Trump in this moment?
I want him to understand that there's a difference between action and loud rhetoric. You know, we see this with General Motors right now. We see it with a lot of things that happen internationally.
The Fed.
I think people do want him to be more careful with his words, but I think they actually like a lot of his agenda.
John Brabender, your words to his ears. Republican strategist Jamal Simmons, Democrat and host at Hill TV. Thank you both for our midweek look at politics. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good rest of the day.
You too. And it sounds like the opening of a comedy sketch. So a group of Trump supporters from coal country Kentucky travels to Massachusetts to sit down with a bunch of liberals. And what? Well, over 2 years, with several trips between Whitesburg, Kentucky and Leverett, Massachusetts, a dialogue broke out. So did mutual respect and friendship, if not agreement. The project is called Hands Across the Hills. It was the brainchild of Leverett, Massachusetts conflict resolution expert Paula Green. Paula is in Amherst, Massachusetts today, and standing by in Whitesburg, Kentucky is Gwen Johnson. But Paula, start with you, the progressive. This idea began in 2016. How?
Right after the election, a group of people in our community got together in the town library to talk about our response. And we didn't know where we would reach out or how we would reach out. But we felt that it was very important to increase as many connectors as we could between people and reduce the dividers, because the deep divides become chasms and then they become cataclysms. And before long, we can't talk to each other at all.
You ended up reaching out to Whitesburg, Kentucky. Gwen, when you heard of this possibility, starting a dialogue with liberals from Western Massachusetts, what was your thought?
Well, I was a little apprehensive, afraid it was another Save the Dumb Hillbillies project. We've really been exploited many times by the media who come in. Look at the very worst of the worst. And we decided to draft an email in response, just asking what the motivation was. Our people in our county voted almost the exact same percentage for Trump that Leverett, Massachusetts voted for Hillary.
Yeah.
I had my reasons for voting for President Trump.
Because candidate Trump promised to revive the coal industry there. Talk about how,
yes.
Yeah, how important was that?
Oh, it's very important because our people don't want handouts. We want an economy that works for all of us. We want to feed the children and put shoes on their feet. And the coal miners here were the benevolent ones who spent their money into keeping the civic organizations and the churches and, you know, all the people who don't have a revenue stream. It was the coal miners who always funded that.
Gwen, I think it was the Kentuckians who first went up to Western Mass. I mean, I've heard this from people who go into communities that are very different from theirs, so from a blue to a red community or a red to blue community. There's almost fear and trepidation. Did you have that when you were coming up to Massachusetts?
Well, I knew it was a conversation that needed to be had, so I just got my courage up and said, okay, I'll be one of the ones who stands out and speaks up. And yeah, there were folks in our group that were very afraid.
What were they afraid of?
That we would not be heard and that we would not be accepted. And the thing that I kept worrying about was that maybe they wouldn't be able to forgive us for voting for President Trump.
Huh. Paula, what was your anticipation when they were coming?
Well, the backstory to this, Robin, is that we spent 6 months preparing for this meeting. This was no casual meeting.
Mm-hmm.
We had endless correspondence and Skypes and phone calls. We had prepared all sorts of community events. We had music and dance and drama and art. And so we had a very full and rich and safe agenda prepared for everybody. And we know how much fear there was even with all that.
What are one of the things you heard that was kind of an aha moment?
The biggest puzzle, I think, for many progressives is why did people vote for this president? And were they voting against their own interests, which we hear over and over again? And I learned that they were voting for their interests because their interest was coal. And Trump promised to bring back coal and Hillary talked about shutting down the mines. So it became very clear to me that these folks were voting a very important interest, their survival. Their basic core needs were not going to be met. We just had to accept that this was what happened and why they voted.
Well, now, Paula, you and your neighbors from Leverett make the trip to Kentucky. Gwen, did you have concerns when they were coming to see you?
Not so much, because we had gotten to know them and to love them by the time that they came and saw us.
Wait a minute, I want to hold up on that. Love them?
Yes.
I would say the same thing, Robin. Yeah. And that's what was astounding for us. We didn't know what was going to transpire between us. And although we don't agree politically, we've come to love and care about each other a great deal.
Well, but Gwen, what was it that you heard that maybe changed your thinking, if at all? You tell me.
Well, they are worried about climate change, just as we are. We're not blind to that, and we're not denying that, but basic human needs overshadow that when you have a mono economy that's built on coal. They don't live in that mono economy that we live in. And so when we heard what they had to say, mm-hmm. it was easier to understand how the divides came about.
Yeah. We're hearing also that there were things like people from Kentucky understood that there were some people in Leverett who directly suffered from the Holocaust, whereas people in Western Mass, Gwen, heard there are transgender people in Kentucky. They didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, so we were enlightened on a lot of points that we were rather blind to.
I think what happened in the end was that we humanized each other. Because the Kentuckian stereotypes of us as liberal elites who didn't care about them, these walls of stereotypes and prejudices came down. Yeah. And what we felt for each other was a very shared humanity at the deepest level. One interesting example was talking about guns. The question that I asked is, what helps you feel safe? And the people in Massachusetts said, when nobody has guns. And the people in Kentucky said, when everybody has guns. But the common thing is, how do we get our safety? And the immigration story was very important because we live in a community that's fairly porous with people coming and going and lots of immigration in the area. I think the people in Kentucky have had much less exposure to that. And they're listening to stories from Holocaust descendants and others whose parents came from various places in Europe and around the world. They learned that the suffering that comes from migration and refugee status and persecution is different than the suffering that comes from lack of jobs in the coal mines, but is nonetheless acute suffering.
Gwen, tell me about your reaction to hearing, obviously there's been such suffering in coal towns, but was that an opening for you? Like, oh, wow, there's, you know, others suffering as well.
Well, I've always been aware of the Holocaust, but didn't have a family connection to that. And so I could really sympathize when they began to talk about the family experiences around that. It was rich to be among them. It was rich. You know, we had in the early days, the coal fields were a melting pot of all nationalities who came here to work. They learned to live side by side developed a brotherhood. And the United Mine Workers of America was never segregated. We've not had a lot of racial divides here. Yeah. And so just to meet the ones who had that history from the Holocaust, it was a rich, rich experience of compassion and love that just prevailed over all the differences.
I got to tell you, I mean, Gwen, I hear the emotion in your voice when you talk about that, and I'm ready to just burst out because this is a glimpse of something that we don't seem to have in this country.
Two things came for us. One is the tremendous pride that people had in mining. World War II, the miners were heroes. They couldn't even be drafted because they had to stay home and keep mining coal for the war effort. And the other thing we heard was the tremendous danger and death. People talk about husbands, fathers, brothers, sons dying in the mines, either from black lung or from boulders that fall. So I think the compassion built up on both sides. And my mission with this is to encourage people to try it. They don't have to try a big 3-day marathon that we try, but even to try an afternoon together and to discover the humanity of the other.
Gwen, I'm sure you have fellow Kentuckians saying, you know, why are you bothering? Or what are they saying?
Well, a lot of them thought we shouldn't make the trip. And they ask, what in the world are you thinking? But I felt that these conversations needed to be had. And how could we not try to bridge this divide when someone was receptive and reaching out to us for that very thing?
Well, Gwen Johnson, I mean, you talk about love. This has just been, you know, so powerful to hear. I think I'm hearing maybe Friends for Life. Is this going to continue?
Yeah, we are continuing. In fact, I was back in Kentucky again in August, and we had a circle with all our Kentucky friends. And in that dialogue circle, they said, we want to come back. So yes. Something very profound and transformative has happened for all of us.
You know, we didn't want to let them leave. We wanted to keep them.
Well, it's just incredible, and we wish you the best. Gwen Johnson from Whitesburg, Kentucky, Paula Green from Leverett, Massachusetts, part of Hands Across the Hills, the project that has found a way to reach across our political divides. Gwen, Paula, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Why don't we hear more of that? Is more of that possible? Weigh in, hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
That Lion Air flight that crashed into the Java Sea last month, killing all 189 people on board, should not have been allowed to fly. That is the word from a new report out today from Indonesian investigators, which also details the pilot's struggle to maintain control of the plane in the final minutes before it crashed. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
And first of all, just remind us what happened on October 29th when this Boeing 737 MAX plane took off from Jakarta.
Yes, it was Lion Air Flight 610, took off from Jakarta, and never gained the kind of altitude that you would have expected it to gain shortly after takeoff. Also had erratic speed. And what seems to have happened, although the Indonesian investigators haven't exactly said this specifically, is that the angle of attack sensors, based on initial reports and other media reports, the plane didn't know what was happening in terms of, you know, how far up the nose was. These are sensors that are in place, of course, to keep people safe, to prevent an airplane from stalling. New systems on this new version of the 737 MAX. But in this case, those same systems perhaps caused the crash, those in conjunction with the pilots, perhaps not knowing exactly what to do about what was happening.
The pilots were trying to override it manually, and they couldn't do that.
Exactly. And it seems that they would have had to take even more perhaps drastic steps that they at least didn't seem to know to take.
Now, the Boeing 737 MAX is a new plane. It entered service only 17 months ago. And pilots are saying that the new manuals don't have the updated procedures for the changes. Boeing disputes that and says the manuals do have updated safety procedures. And it says the pilots who flew the plane the day before followed them correctly when they noticed the exact same problem of the nose dipping. Who's right here?
Right. And of course, that alone, an important fact, and from the perspective of the Indonesian investigators, the most important fact that something went terribly wrong the day before, things worked out then, you know, why was this airplane in the air? Even pilots have disagreed here. Southwest and American, just among U.S. pilots, their leadership have said, yeah, this was not specifically enough spelled out. United Airlines pilots kind of disagreed, said, well, it was kind of in there. But what's rather clear is that you had at least some pilots out there who didn't either fully appreciate or didn't know what to do in a situation like this. At least that cockpit crew of the doomed flight didn't know.
So what is the buzz in the airline industry about this, Seth, right now, about the 737 MAX, which is Boeing's fastest selling plane?
Yeah, look, they've still taken orders. There was a small order last week from Caribbean Airlines. So, it's not as though no airlines are interested in ordering this plane. One of our big customers up in Canada, WestJet, deferred a few of them, but that was rather clearly due to economic, financial issues at the airline. This is going to be a workhorse of the fleet going forward. And I think, airlines in general are confident that one way or another, this will get solved. Just like other problems do. It's really frustrating and tragic to think that same plane had these problems. Usually a crash requires several different things going wrong. Mm-hmm. You have redundancies in place. And in this case, at least part of it should have been that why was that plane flying? Jeremy, you and I spoke immediately right following the crash. And with much less information then, I sort of said, that seemed to be a question. Now, investigators are agreeing with that.
Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And we're continuing our look now at last week's fourth national climate assessment. It got buried on the Thanksgiving weekend, so we're unearthing it. The assessment, commissioned by Congress and compiled by 300 scientists from 13 federal agencies, issued a dire warning to Midwest farmers, telling them it's not the coast, but American agriculture that will bear the brunt of rising temperatures, heavier rainfall, and more extreme weather patterns. Jim Angel is Illinois state climatologist and was the lead author on the report's chapter on the Midwest. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So gloomy. It's a gloomy, gloomy report, but go a little deeper. Yes, we know there are going to be rising temperatures, heavier rainfall, more extreme weather, but tell us more about how that affects farmers and the Midwest in particular.
That's right. If you look at the impacts on the Midwest from climate change, right now what we see primarily are the impacts of more rainfall and more heavy rainfall events. So that gives us trouble, for example, with springtime planting. If it's too wet, you can't plant. Or if you did plant, it gets flooded out and you have to replant. So there's cost involved with that. And also and that doesn't take drought off the table. So even though we're getting more rainfall events, we also have had a lot of short-term or what we call flash droughts in the summertime that can be a big problem. We saw that especially in Missouri this year. So I would say that's probably the biggest concern. Probably the other concern is the impacts of temperature. And in some ways, it's the off-season temperatures that are bothering them, in that when you have the wintertime, if it doesn't get cold enough, a lot of pests can actually survive the winter underground. And so they come out in spring and they're ready to go. So it can also impact the prevalence of pests and other pathogens.
Well, just hold you up there for a second, because we have been hearing farmers speak on this. And some of them are very much, as you say, witnessing what they say, what they see as climate change. Others are seeing it as part of a process. As you said, it's been going on. So, for instance, Blake Hurst, who's president of the Missouri Farm Bureau, said when the report came out that it was disturbing, but farmers will adapt as they always have. and that it doesn't matter if the U.S. tries to respond to climate change because there are countries, India and China, that are, you know, trying to aspire to Western living standards. And we know this, you know, getting their first cars, for instance, that aren't going to do that. So it really, it doesn't really matter. What are you hearing from farmers that you speak to?
Yeah, you know, it does run the spectrum. So some farmers are very in tune to that and some are not so much. And, you know, I mean, farmers like everybody else, they've got some have been there long term, some short term. We have some farms in the Midwest that are multi-generational. So they've experienced the growing seasons since the turn of the 20th century or even earlier. So depending on where you are, it can be a big difference. I would say some areas it's probably more pronounced than other areas, too. So that also comes into play. So, you know, if you talk to a farmer in Iowa, they might have a different story than someone from Indiana, for example.
Well, but the biggest headline that's been coming out of this is if nothing is done about climate change by 2050, Midwest farmers could see their productivity decrease to a level not seen since the 1980s. This is from a paper out of Champaign, Illinois, the News Gazette. What does that mean to farmers, the 1980s?
Yeah, so the 1980s, definitely lower production. During that time, we also had some issues with droughts. The big drought of 1988 was in there. And also we had the big flood of 1993, which was also very detrimental to yields as well. So being too wet or too dry is a problem. Also, the genetics back then were not as good as they are today. So the yields were much lower than they are right now. And I think that's one of the things, it's kind of an arms race. So we've got changing climate, and then can we keep up with it with better genetics or better field practices? And it is a race. So we'll see who wins. But the concern is that the climate is going to change so fast that the genetics are not going to be able to keep up, at least in the short term.
Yeah. But does that headline, while it certainly is attention-grabbing for farmers who remember that time, does that also maybe give somebody reason to believe that, well, if we got through the 80s, we'll get through this?
Yeah, well, yes, that is true. That I think that the important thing to keep in mind was in the 1980s, our productivity was much less, and world demand was also less at that point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we got more people to feed now across the world, so the demand is much higher than ever before. And so I think that's going to come into play, too. So if we have multi-years of poor production, that's going to be a game changer.
No, game changer. One of the disturbing lines that I read was that, you know, the high temperatures, intensity of the high temperatures, of course that's going to be a problem for crops. But when it comes to farmers, people who work outside, it's going to increase heat exhaustion, heat stroke, heart attacks in people, and heat stress in livestock.
Yes, farm workers and anybody that works outside in the Midwest are going to be vulnerable to more heat. And there was a startling report by the U.S. EPA on the economic impacts, and they were listed the Midwest as being losses on the order of $1 billion per year from lost productivity because of that.
Well, and water. Water is so key to farming and irrigation. You'd think if one of the issues is there's going to be a lot of rain, won't that offset concerns about water?
To some extent. The problem is that when you get heavy rainfall events, it all falls at once, and so then it all runs off at once. Also, when you get big rain events, it also washes away soils and the nutrients as well. So it's going to be a bigger water management problem moving forward. So getting the water off the fields in the spring and retaining enough water on the fields for soil moisture to get you through the growing season. So there's going to be probably more work done in those areas to strike the right balance.
And another thing about the Midwest, you know, it gets its own chapter here, is that it's rural. And in many places, there's poverty. As opposed to, as awful as they are when weather incidents strike city areas, there's a difference there. Explain.
Yeah, so what we've found is that if you drive around any of the Midwestern states, a lot of times there is as much poverty in rural areas as there are in the big cities. And even worse, they don't have the social services to help them out. So if you're dozens of miles away from the nearest medical facility, so if they do get heat stroke or have any kind of problems like that, it takes a lot longer to get them to a hospital. And also, their living conditions may not be that great either. So, if you're living in a trailer out in the middle of a field with no shade, you know that's you're just getting baked there.
Yeah. Look, what's to be done? You can't keep people from getting baked if they're working in the fields. But what about seeds? What are some of the things that you think farmers should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think that I'm sure the seed companies are already working on new varieties that will be more robust to climate change. And like I said, some of these other practices, cover crops and things like that during the off season, will also offset some of the problems we've had with soil erosion and those kinds of things.
Look, you talk about this being a game changer. You've said that you expect the Corn Belt to shift north a little bit. You know, a whole industry is kind of on the move. You and a team of writers and scientists doing all this research spent a year writing this. It's been vetted by 13 federal agencies. And yet we have, you know, the president saying, you know, you look at our air and our water, it's at record clean. And he's pointing to, echoing some of the farmers we're hearing from, pointing to China and India as having the problems. You had Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke downplay the reports. He said it was based on the worst scenarios. You say what?
Well, I think we did our best at trying to strike the balance of showing the concerns moving forward, but also identifying bright spots. We do have a lot of work in there that talks about adaptation measures on for climate change, and so that I think that's the upside of it. And also, we do show that if you take the lower emission pass, you do get better results than if you continue with business as usual. So it's kind of interesting that we talk about actually the worst case scenario for us is business as usual. It means not doing anything. So anything we do is going to be better than that particular case. I also think, you know, farmers and other groups, they're problem solvers. They got real problems right now. And so, you know, regardless of where your political affiliation is, you got to address these problems.
And you think they will?
I think they will. I think there's groups already, farmers, city managers and planners are already addressing many of the issues we've talked about.
Jim Angel, Illinois state climatologist and the lead author of the National Climate Assessments chapter on the Midwest and largely agriculture and farming. Jim, thank you and best to you.
Yes, thank you.
And tomorrow we'll speak with another of the assessment's co-authors. How can we expect climate change to affect water?
This is Here and Now. The CDC now says some romaine lettuce is safe to eat. The government traced the outbreak of E. coli to romaine grown in California's Central Coast region, so romaine that isn't grown there is considered okay. Martin Weidman is professor of food science at Cornell University. Welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. So how do you think the CDC handled this outbreak of E. coli, issuing a warning the other day that said, outbreak alert, do not eat any romaine lettuce, including whole heads and hearts, chopped organic and salad mixes with romaine until we learn more. If you don't know if it's romaine or can't confirm the source, don't eat it.
This was a tough one for CDC and I think for all of us. And the backstory here is that we had a very similar outbreak about a year ago, December, January. And I think because of that outbreak, everyone was very nervous because we knew that this outbreak was caused by the same strain as back then. It is unusual to put out such a broad warning for such a, you know, popular and commonly consumed item. But I think CDC just needed more time and probably thought they had to do something before Thanksgiving.
Well, of course, you don't want anyone to get sick or die from E. coli. You also don't really want to maybe, you know, cause a lot of economic harm to producers of romaine lettuce that didn't do anything wrong, that their lettuce is completely safe to eat, and we're going to be wasting a lot of food because of this warning.
Exactly, and I think that's one of the challenges we have. As we get better and better tools to detect smaller and smaller outbreaks, when do we put out these broad-based warnings to basically take off a commonly consumed food completely, and how long do we wait until we know more specifics, which company, which area?
Well, and is the best way to get the word out a warning like that? I was out over the weekend at a restaurant and I watched a Caesar salad go by, but it had kale in it rather than romaine. And I wondered, is every restaurant, is every store around the country really aware of the latest of what they're allowed to put out there and what they're not, just because the CDC puts out an alert like that?
So technically, one could argue this is not your typical recall where, you know, you have a certain company saying company X recalled their romaine in bags, and then they have to inform all of their customers that purchase the product. In this case, it's really a broad do not consume warning. We really don't know how to most effectively bring this down to everyone. And even with the classical recalls, which is one company, a specific product, we've had problems in the past, and we often had product that was recalled still served after the recall was announced.
Don't we have the capability, though, to really be more specific at this point? Like, what is the capability right now of CDC to figure out that it was this particular producer of lettuce that was the problem, and so we'll just issue a warning about this rather than all romaine?
It is very hard to get that specific because one thing we need to remember is we don't have any romaine lettuce that tested positive for this E. coli. Mm. Sometimes this can be a few days of harvest that are contaminated. They're then consumed, and by the time we identify an outbreak, all of that product already disappeared. It becomes then very, very difficult to trace it back because people don't write down lot numbers on the bags of romaine they eat.
Should they have
that specificity. I don't think so. I think that's probably overkill for all products. But I do think as we move towards different food distribution, e-commerce, it will become easier and easier for people. But then if you purchase local produce, you know, a roadside stand or a store around the corner, often it doesn't even have a lot number attached to it. So,
but if you purchase local produce, you're not going to have a nationwide problem. It'll just be a problem in your local area probably.
Yeah, that's what one would hope for, but it depends on where some of this product that is sold locally in a store might not always mm-hmm. be sourced locally too. I think we have to be realistic there.
So what would you advise consumers at this point? Because it's only been a matter of days since this outbreak was brought to our attention. I mean, I don't really feel comfortable having romaine for at least another week or two, I would say, until it all clears out through the system. But is that irrational of me?
Probably wouldn't call it irrational, but I don't think I would go that far. I think CDC, FDA are very clear that as soon as you have product that is labeled with an origin, where you know it came from Mexico, came from Florida, came from the desert regions in California, that product is safe to consume. But if you see romaine lettuce that is not clearly labeled with a country or an origin where it was produced, I would probably not necessarily take that one.
This is, as you said, the second E. coli outbreak associated with romaine lettuce in the last year. Is there something inherently unsafe about romaine?
No, I don't think there's anything. We don't have any evidence there's something specifically problematic with romaine more so than others. This one is another example. It shows that the system is working. We have a very good system to detect outbreaks when they're much smaller than when they used to be. This outbreak probably wouldn't have been detected 8 or 10 years ago. Now with better tools, DNA fingerprinting, better surveillance, we try to find out what the cause is and try to fix it to continuously improve the food system. So in my mind, no need to stay away from romaine in general.
That's Martin Weidman, professor in the Department of Food Science at Cornell University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.